Hey, welcome back to Deep Fried Bites. This is part two of David Larrabee's talk with Keith and I about domain-driven design. Today, we're going to pick up the show kind of halfway through, and we're going to talk about entities, value objects, etc., etc., etc. Welcome back. If you haven't listened to the last episode where we talked about a lot of the introduction stuff with domain-driven design, go back, listen to that. I'm just rambling on, so let's get into the show.
What else is there? You mentioned core pattern earlier. You mentioned entities. Go down that rabbit hole of some other things that kind of tie in and bring that together and make it happen.
So when we're inside of a bounded context and we start to think about the things and we know what the language is, we know the language our domain experts are using, we can start teasing apart pieces of that language into a common pattern language. It's a lot of language, but stick with me. All right, so you have entity. Entity is really a thing. It's a noun. It's a person, place, or thing. Now, it could be a verb as well. We'll leave that on the table, just throwing that out there so I don't get dinged. But let's just say it's a person, place, or thing. It's a noun. In the case of loan is your entity. Now, what distinguishes an entity from just a regular old class or object is that an entity has identity. It has a real kind of ID associated with it. Typically, you'll find people use like things like GUIDs or longs to represent that identity. But
now, why do you say that? Why do you say that it has to have an identity of a GUID or like a primary key in a database or an ID attached to it?
It must be uniquely identifiable. Now, you can go down the path of like a person has social security number. Well, what if we're dealing with people in, I don't know, France? Or people in, you know, they might have a country ID. I have no idea. But, you know, I would caution against necessarily using a person, like a real ID. Just like in database design, I think I would use an arbitrary ID. Now, yeah, oftentimes you're going to want to find that person based on their social security number. But what if that person is, you know, on a NAFTA visa? What if that person is one? They may not have a social security number. So typically, just as an aside, we use GUIDs or longs or ints or whatever. But the main point here is that thing has an ID. Another thing with an entity is entity has a very discrete, it has a very you know, concrete life cycle. It begins its life, it is created. It lives for a while, and that can live between, you know, requests. That can live in durable storage in a database or something. And it also dies at a certain point. It is deleted.
Oh, the poor entity dies.
It's sad. It really is.
That's so sad.
Yeah. But all entities go to heaven, so we can be comforted by that fact. So an entity has a life cycle, an entity has an ID. And I tend to think of entities in, you know, as people, places, or things. All right, so that is one of the main ideas. So in the example of a loan, we might have a loan entity, we might have a payment entity, we might have a payment terms entity, we'll have all those things. Again, we want to focus on our bounded context, and we want to keep that. That keeps us from going insane and having these 300 entity domain models. So then the other kind of primary.
Okay, hang on right there.
Yeah.
Question. Can I use an entity that was built in one bounded context and reuse it in another?
Absolutely. What you will do, though, is
I was worried about having to rewrite that code again.
No, I didn't say that, right? I think you can do whatever you want to. I'm not here to tell you what to do, but I think that you're going to want to probably transform that into. So let's imagine that we've got this loan application and we're going to set up a loan. And we've got this context that's just our core domain that represents our main concepts. It doesn't have a lot of logic in it. It's more data oriented or whatever. But when we set up that loan, we want to fire off a message to our other contacts saying, hey, also set up a loan. So we're going to say set up a loan for payment for accounts receivable. Set up a loan for, you know, for whatever, whoever's in charge of upselling or whatever. Set up a loan for regulatory reporting. Set up a loan for inside the data mart or the data warehouse. So when that message comes through, typically what we'll do is then create the particular loan representation that's needed in that bounded context. But the idea is that back to identity, we really have this notion of loan that might have the same identity in at all of these contexts. You know, it may be, it looks a little different over here in payment and accounts receivable than it does over here in regulatory reporting. I just made these contexts up, by the way. I don't know if they make any sense, but it looks a little.
They don't.
Okay, awesome. give me two contexts.
Qualification, make sure they pass all the fees, calculate fees, and then if everybody, if all the children agree, then we'll do a loan. So you can take from that wherever you want to start with.
Okay. Qualification might be a bounded context. And then approval might be its own, because you probably have crazy rules about approval and the credit checks and stuff like that. So you might have a credit check service, and you know, we'll get there. So we'll stick with qualification and approval. Is that a little?
That's fine.
Okay. So unpacking a little bit, in the case where you have qualification, that's probably where you're going to be assigning your identity, right? That's where the loans are born. But when I qualify, when I return that to whatever my application consuming, and I've got these four loans that I qualify for with a certain ID, I'm going to pass that ID into when I go to say, here's the loan I selected. Now approve, you know, that really internally, this is good. We're going to take this. We're going to make this happen. So that ID may, the point is that ID may appear twice across bounded contexts. Or it may be the inside, the glue part of the thing connecting these bounded contexts is where we maintain that mapping of ID. The takeaway here is that the loan kind of is represented differently in different bounded contexts, but it really is logically the same loan. That's entities. I think we've done entities to death. It's a really pretty simple concept. Value objects are another pattern, and really we can think of those as descriptors. They're properties on our entities. There's a few things about value objects that we want to try to keep them immutable so that they cannot be changed. And in implementation terms, that usually means private read-only fields, and we take what we need in the constructor. So we think of something like date time. That's a good example of a value object. You can't really, once you create the date time, change the date time. You can add time to it, but that notice that returns a new date time rather than changing the inside, you know, the innards of the date time variable that you have. So the reason for that is, you know, you think about color or you think about examples of things we would maybe consider properties. They are what they are. You know, there's one of them. You don't really mutate red. You know, you can add blue to red to get purple, but that's just another value object. So
sure.
Our value objects really are just kind of our properties. They're kind of our descriptions. And when we're modeling stuff, we want to try to avoid things like, say we were modeling a customer relationship management system, and we had this model that was our customer and we had phone number. Rather than use a string, it might be a pretty good idea to actually create a phone number value object. And that phone number would enforce the, you know, would have a property and an area code, which would be a number, and it would have a property on it, country, which might be a string or might be another value object, country. So we want to try to keep those pretty, you know, I think that's one thing I see a lot is that there's a tendency to shy away from that pattern. I would try to model the things that live in your domain.
You know, money's a great example of that where you could, where in, you know, like I've seen people like, well, I need to validate that this is money, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll write some regular expression to validate that they got some value dot some other value, and they're all numbers, right? Kind of a simple reg X. But really, when you start taking in a financial institution and you start taking in money, money has a lot of properties to it. Which country is it bound to? So if I take U.S. dollars and translate it to France, I'm going to get different types of money, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's another. That's probably maybe a more complex example, but that's another example. Phone numbers are example. Maybe what about like email?
Sure, it can
be. Would you go that far?
You could go that far. I mean, I think look at your domain and money's a, I think money's a really good example. Say our domain is something like a general ledger, and we're modeling a general ledger. You know, we've all done that at one point. And I think money is a totally reasonable value object to have in there. Or if our domain is like a shopping cart, money is a totally reasonable thing to be in there. If our domain is something like document management, say, then money maybe might be a little overkill. Decimal might cut it. You know, so just be sure. Be pragmatic about it. We have a limited amount of time to go in and create stuff. So I would pick the heavy hitters. Money tends to be one of the ones that usually you find money object. There's a lot on the web. If you Google money pattern, you'll find a bunch of stuff. So value objects, we won't belabor it too much, but it's an important idea. They're immutable generally, and I try to always make them immutable so they cannot change. And any functions in the value object do not change the state of the value object themselves. They would just return a new copy of that value object. So we have entities. We've got value objects. We need sometimes in our model, like say we're doing loan qualification, maybe we have a credit check service. Or in the loan approval model, we've got a credit check, this notion of credit check. Well, that doesn't really necessarily fit into the idea of an entity. It's still a very business specific thing, credit check, but it's not, you know, it's kind of a process. So service is a pattern where we could model credit checks. Now, the big thing with services, they're stateless and they are domain specific. So services is one of those like hyper overloaded concepts. It's kind of like component. You know, or specification means like 18 different things, depending on what you're talking about. In domain-driven design, a service really should represent one discrete little operation. The example given in the book and the example that I've talked about in the past is funds transfer. Now, in the case of funds transfer in like an accounting thing, we want a debit from, we're transferring from one account to another account. We're debiting the from account and we're crediting the to account. Well, we could put transfer on the account itself that takes the target account. But that's a little awkward. So rather, let's create a funds transfer service with a method called transfer that takes the two accounts and the amount you want to transfer. Now, say we've got a really crappy bank and that bank does something like charges the source account a fee when the transfer happens. We've got some dependency that's determining the fee, like a fee service. Still a business service, a business concept that's going to get us our feedback. It's going to tell us what the fee of the day is, and it's going to add to the debit of the original account that fee plus the amount transferred. But rather than have that dependency be in our entity and have that, you know, we have this thing hanging off of our entity, we would use a service also to deal with awkward dependencies or awkward behaviors between two kinds of entities. Does that make sense?
Okay, now I have a question here. Okay, when I think of the word service, in today's context, I immediately think of a SOA, services-oriented architecture, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a SOAP, XML, remoting call, or something like that. I don't get that that's really what you're saying. You're just saying a service. Is that really another name for a method or an action that something
happens?
That's
what it sounds like to me.
It really is. I tend to think of it as kind of like a process. You know, it's a business process that happens in our model. It's happened, you know, in the book it's called service. But yeah, essentially, your services in a DDD sense are going to be very business specific. They're going to appear in that ubiquitous language we talked about, or the business language, or the shared language. And they're going to tend to have one method, one public method.
Calculate tax fees, for example,
exactly.
on a loan.
But
or something.
What you think about, that doesn't necessarily model all that well in an entity. Where in our entities, we want to kind of keep them free of dependencies and we want to kind of keep them, their behavior local to the entity. In a service, we would use a service to kind of keep that external or to deal with multiple entities so we didn't have to go create a spider web of associations and relationships between all the entities. We can keep things sane there. But it does, you know, sometimes we have a verb that just does not fit well with the entity concept. I'm sorry, Keith, what were you going to say?
I just want to remind everybody that a model is a code and a code is a model. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. I'd like to say anything there.
Okay.
Do you think that the book references it as service because not all languages call something a method? Some people have functions, they have procedures, so it's that's a generic term to mean function, method, procedure.
No. It's a separate class.
It's a separate class in your model.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
It's a separate class.
That really simulates an action. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
Take that to code for me real quick. So if I've got a something that, like I said earlier, it calculates taxes for a loan. Give me the class that it's in that you think it would be in, and then give me what I would do with that.
So let's say we've got a tax calculator. That tax calculator class takes a loan that says calculate tax. And it takes a loan and it returns a money, a value object.
As a constructor, or is it a static method?
It's just a method. It would avoid statics, but it's just a method. So we have tax calculation service or tax calculator. It's got a method called, it's kind of hard to talk about code on a podcast, but it's got a method called calculate tax that takes a loan. That loan, and then so inside that method, we're going to do a couple things. In the constructor of that tax calculator, we're going to take a dependency called maybe like tax lookup service or something like that, where we actually look up the tax rates or whatever. So this whole class's responsibility is going to be to orchestrate that interaction between the lookup, where we look up the tax rate du jour, or the tax rate for the calendar year. I guess it probably changes annually. We're going to look up the tax rate based on the loan's state or the loan's town. Then what we'll do is maybe what we do is we don't even return anything, but we just change the tax rate on the loan itself. Now you'd say, why don't we just have that in the loan? Because if we put the tax lookup right inside of our loan, we run into issues with testability, right? Where we have to dependency inject that tax lookup service right into our loan entity. Entities you want to kind of keep scoped to just what they do. You know, they're focused on, they're very self-absorbed things. So we want to really use a service to deal with that orchestration. Now I brought up the example of the funds transfer. In that case, we've got two accounts. And we're going to have a class called funds transfer service. That class is going to have a method called transfer funds. Okay. And transfer funds is going to take a source account, a target account, and the amount to transfer. Well, sure, on the account, we could put a method transfer that took an account and took a money. But it's a little awkward, right? An account itself doesn't transfer its own funds. That's initiated from outside of the account. We really need debit and credit, which are on the account. Those are account behaviors. So we're going to debit the balance. We're going to credit the balance.
Right.
In the case where we were going to do a fee, you know, you can see where that might, we want to model that as a separate service, a separate class. Now, I think this comes back to a very common principle in object-oriented programming is that you want kind of single responsibility per class. Class should only have one reason to change. Or a class should have a single responsibility. So I'm a big fan of putting it that way. So classes should do one thing. Let's not say one thing. Let's say a class should do one category of things. One thing's a little extreme. You know, we're going to end up with millions of classes in our solution. But in the case of a loan, the loan is going to manage itself. That's it. But it's not going to approve itself. We're going to maybe use a service for that. A loan isn't going to check the credit of the customer. We're going to use a service for that that might take the loan because that's how we get to the customer. Is that making sense? Services are a little tricky.
It is. We've all seen code that does die, you know, that does something like, loan, new loan equals, a new loan object, right? And then I can say long dot, you know, value equals this and long dot something equals that and stack all of the data onto the loan object, right? And then I can call something like loan dot qualify, right? So the loan object is actually performing the qualification. And I've seen code like that. I think I probably have actually written code like that in my life at some point, I know. But what you're saying is that's loans don't really qualify themselves. Some other business process tells the loan to go qualify itself. The loan passes its data and its whatever that it needs to that service, and that's the difference.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think there's a really important point to bring up here, though. There's a very healthy tension between entities and service, and that you want to try to put as much behavior in the entity as you can. You don't want your entities just to be kind of dumb little data objects. They should be, they're behavioral things. So in the case, in the example you brought up, Keith, I think a loan, it's totally cool to have a qualify method there that would change the state to indicate that the loan's qualified. You know, if that's how it works. But I think you might want to wrap that whole thing up where that qualify is actually called. You might want to have a qualification service that does a number of other domain-specific things around that qualification.
Right.
And then at one point calls qualify, the loan's good to go, you know, and we're cooking with gas.
Yeah, I mean, like, the entity should say, look, dummy, you put this crazy phone number in me, and I don't know how to deal with that. That's not the right format. Or, you know, your loan amount can't be negative. You know, those types of business rules and those types of, you know, data integrity things. The entity should know how to protect itself and know what's good, know what's bad, how to secure itself, those things. But when it interacts with something else, you know, that's where the service boundary comes in. That's not really a boundary, but that's where the service comes in.
See, I don't know if I agree totally with that. I mean, I guess the object needs to protect itself, but I think that when a entity calls out to one of these services, and correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't care about what's happening out there as long as it either gets some type of error back, which it can process on, or it gets some type of result that says this is the current state at the end of the service.
I mean, so I want to kind of focus on one thing you said there is that entities generally don't call services. Entities tend to be like their own little self-contained blobs. And let me give you an example of entity behavior from my domain, insurance policies. At a certain point, and this is something everyone can relate to, because your policy gets renewed typically annually, whether it's an auto policy, a comp policy, general liability, whatever, it doesn't matter. It gets renewed, ideally, if you haven't, you know.
When it does get renewed, hopefully it's cheaper. But
hopefully it's cheaper.
Can you fix that for us in your program?
No. You know, all of insurance is essentially programming the word no into it's a very simple domain. But so we've got a policy entity, and just to throw a wrench in the works, there's this other pattern called aggregate root. So our entities, and I'll drill in a little, but the entities tend not to exist in isolation. So if we think about an insurance policy, a policy has one or more periods. It starts out with the initial period. That's your when you go to Geico and, you know, you get your initial first year, right? So it's when a policy's set up, it's got that first year period, an auto policy, say. Well, now we've got two entities, policy and period, but they're really in one logical chunk. They're in a kind of their own boundary. They are what's called an aggregate root. The root of the aggregate is actually the policy. I'll get down to some of the rules associated with aggregates, but we're talking about entity behavior. So I might have on policy a method called renew, and the behavior might be to iterate through, you know, this would be a great application of link, right? Give me the last period chronologically, and then copy that into a new period. Okay, certainly there's a lot of business logic associated with renewals. Keith, you hit on the hopefully it goes down in price. You know, repricing is a big part of renewal. But we don't have enough information in this complex of policy and its associated periods, this aggregate root, to be able to do all that. We do have enough to be able to go in and create, duplicate the last period. You know, bring over all the information about your vehicle. Obviously, some of that's going to have to change. Like, we might have a method called write on the period that would actually, or put in effect, and that would put that period into, or complete renewal. That would complete the renewal, and that method might take what the new rate is, and that's going to be determined out there with it by a service. Or that method might take in what the mileage of your car is at the beginning of renewal period, whatever. We won't go too deeply into that. The point is that some behavior, as much behavior as you can, should go into the entity just so that they're not these data containers. But the services are going to deal with, like, where we've got a ton of associations, or we've got weird things happening, or we've got this legacy system over here that we need to interact with, and we kind of want to hide that, you know, from the domain, the goodness, the purity of our domain. Is that kind of cleared up as far as the relationship between services and entities?
Clear as mud.
Yeah. As clear as DD. I mean, I'll tell you the honest truth. I think DDD takes a while to get, and I get most of it, but you're intriguing me to go out and learn a lot more about it. So I get most of it, as much as what we've been talking for about an hour and a half about it. I mean, it's something that takes probably a lot of practice too. I mean, I think you have to do a lot of this to really get it.
Have you ever needed to understand how your .NET code is behaving or why it isn't behaving the way you want it to? It's easy with a code profiler like Ants Profiler from Redgate. It can help you locate performance bottlenecks really quickly. It provides you with quantitative data such as hit count and code timings. It is ideal if you want to improve parts of your applications and make your algorithms run more efficiently. You can download a 14-day free trial of Ants Profiler from http://red-gate.com.
When you talk to people that have never done DDD and you bring them into your business, how long until they actually get it? What have you seen?
Typically, they get it pretty quickly. I mean, you're talking about like bringing in new developers?
Yeah. Let's say you brought a new developer into your organization, and of course you guys are doing DDD stuff, you know, and they have to actually write code. How long until they actually sort of do it correctly? They built the right entity. They didn't put, you know, services inside the entity. They broke them out. They've got, you know, all of those things done.
We bring in developers, and we just hired a new guy, and we keep them focused on the UI for about two months, because we do everything so differently. When we bring them up to, when we introduce DDD or what they're doing, you know, with modeling, we actually let them get used to test-driven development and extreme programming and all the other things that we're doing, because we're doing a ridiculous number of things.
Right.
We have that, and it's a problem, but I think, you know, we're looking at it. I think the value is there enough to absorb the learning curve typically that's associated with it. The last thing we kind of tend to show them is the DDD stuff, or that we not necessarily show them. We don't hold it back, but we say, okay, now let's get you working on as a modeler. This kind of goes to the point, I think, where your senior developers should be the ones kind of at least shepherding or stewarding the model, because it's hard. I mean, the book is very dense. It's not, and you don't need this for every application. Some applications are fine with Active Record or just a DAO, you know? That's totally legitimate thing. Where you might need this is the stuff we've been talking about with a loan, where it's really complex logic, you know, and it's core logic. It's a core competency of the company. That's right. Where you want to employ something like this. So we don't just, you know, it's not like everything we have is DDD. We just, you know, employ it in select areas that we want to invest in.
I've heard that several times that, you know, most people, you tend to focus your senior developers at the domain model level, and because they should know or understand the business concepts and complexity. You hope, it's like you said earlier in conversation, at one point. Maybe we talked at some other conference or something that you want people that have really good communication skills that are doing the domain model, and developers that have better communication skills tend to do better with this than ones that don't. So if we can find a senior level developer that can communicate very, very well with the business and understands the business, they're sort of your go-to guy or girl in a DDD model.
Yeah, I think so. I think typically this is a point brought up in the book, is that the senior developers are the ones that are figuring out like MSMQ or Windows Workflow, or, you know, and that's great. But really, I think we need to think of senior developers as the people that really know the business inside and out. And they tend to be the people that have been there for a while, and they know, you know, they know where the skeletons in the closet are, and they know how the business works, and they've kind of been around the block a little bit. I think when you're trying to introduce this to someone, you just have to read the book. The book is a little bit like, I heard someone describe it as kind of the Lord of the Rings of computer books. And that, you know, if you've ever read Lord of the Rings, it's like Gimli, son of Gloin, son of blah, son of, you know, and it's really intense. It's only like 300 characters in it. But, and I wouldn't just go applying this for applying this sake, but I would say anyone that's doing object systems, there's a few, you're going to pick up some things you can benefit from, even if you're not going to go hardcore DDD. And it's not the only way to go. Let's be honest about that.
So if you don't go DDD, what do you use? Where do you go?
I think Active Record is a fine pattern for simple applications where, you know, you're doing kind of like forms over data stuff, or you just want to get something in a database. I think the dynamic data, the ASP.NET thing, I think that's not a bad thing for people that are, you know,
just want to get something up and running and get data in and out.
You want a web database, you know, you want to get that in there, and that's fine. And I think that works for a lot of applications. I think that, you know, even like some of, I don't know. I mean, I think we've all probably rolled our own DAL or code gen that or something like that. And there are issues with that as far as if you want to deploy testing. We won't go down that path. But there are a number of ways to get data in a database. I would kind of really caution against thinking domain-driven design is about getting data in a database. It's really about cordoning off business logic. And it's really about like building a blob of maintainable goodness that will last forever, ideally, you know, keeping that complexity.
So,
there.
David, I've got a question. Since Keith and I are .NET developers primarily, how do you see DDD fitting in and working well? Does it work well with the .NET CLR and the framework and languages like C# and VB.NET?
I assume it works great in VB because it works great in C#. It just looks probably a little different. But I think it's a very, you know, a lot of people in the Java community are doing this. And in some respects, you know, we have very comparable platform. So it works pretty well. And there, you'll look at tools like in Hibernate as supporting at least like the persistence requirement associated with a model. And Hibernate's an object relational mapper. I'm sure everyone's heard about it. There are people have posted about using Link to SQL to store their models. So, I wouldn't say we're doing domain-driven design with Link to SQL. Link to SQL is supporting the fact that our domain models done with domain-driven design, that's a lot of Ds, our domain models need to be saved somewhere at some point. They just don't live in memory all the time. So I think there are a lot of tools that are out there, either open source or provided by Microsoft or commercial tools, that can be used to facilitate some of the infrastructure realities around a domain model, like we got to save our stuff. Other than that, C# is a first class object oriented language, and I find it's a little kind of sad that, you know, the .NET developer community tends to be more kind of, I think, attached to the database stuff than trying to create, you know, real object-oriented systems, for at least for their transactional applications, when in fact we have a fantastic platform for it. So I think that going out there and doing that, you can really make some really cool models with C sharp. I mean, there's a lot of syntax sugar, especially in 3.5, that you can, you know, doing things with extension methods and lambdas and so forth to really make things pretty sharp.
I would love to have that conversation and just go down that rabbit hole of what somebody in C sharp would actually do, taking one of the contexts that we did, like, you know, taking the context of a loan, or even in your business, insurance. Those are two things that pretty much most people have, you know, had either a loan or they've had to buy insurance. So it's something that's fairly easy to grok from a high level. Okay, on the core pattern languages stuff, we talked about entities, value objects, services. What else are we missing for, like, you know, some of the core things around DDD, Dave?
Right. So I touched briefly on aggregate root. I won't go super deep into that. Got to read the book. But essentially, that's just going to be little complexes or little, think of the aggregate symbol in UML. It's that black diamond. That means that we've got two classes. They belong together. They go together. If I delete the parent, the child gets deleted. The main thing to remember with aggregates is that you can only have a reference, a permanent reference to the root. You don't want to keep a reference to the sub. So we mentioned policy and period. Nowhere in your application or your model, other than the policy, are you allowed to have a permanent reference to period. You can have a transitive reference where you feed that period into some service, but you have to let go of that. And the reason is to keep things sensible so that you don't just have the spider web of dependencies and associations. Aggregate root is
sense.
A little finer point. I don't want to dwell on it. It's a very important thing, but we got a lot to cover. So the next one, I think it's a really key one, is repository. Repository is really just kind of looks like an in-memory collection of entities or aggregate roots. There tends to be one repository for aggregate root. In the example of policy, you would have a repository for the policy. You would not have a repository for the period. One repository per aggregate root. It's an in-memory collection, so we have methods on there like find one or find all, or find by query, or find by these arguments. We also have methods like save. So rather than in our entity having something like policy p equals new policy p.save, we have policy repository.save p. And so what we're doing with the repository is abstracting out how these things are retrieved, how they're saved. And that's where we want to put like our database logic. That's where we want to use a tool like in Hibernate or a tool like Link to SQL or something like that to actually get that saving done.
Yep, makes sense.
So it's pretty simple. I'm a big fan of on the repository having very specific methods for like find unapproved loans or find, you know, policies that need renewal. I like long methods.
It sounds like you're bringing over some ubiquitous language into the repository almost.
Yeah, you guys are good. You're going to be old hats by the time we're done with this conversation. That's exactly what it is. A ubiquitous language everywhere in the class names, in the method names, stuff like that. So that's repository. I think we should probably cut it there. There's a few other things. Factory. I'll just go through like the basic just to kind of. Maybe so when people encounter these, they'll at least have a sense of what they are. A factory is a creational pattern. It's very much like the Gang of Four factory, and it's about creating an entity in the right state. So in the case of a policy, we may need to have a policy, but we also need an audit set up to make sure that at the end of that first period, we're going to go back and contact the policyholders to make sure that they're paying what they should. So that's a complex thing involving multiple entities, but they need to all be there from the get-go. So we would use a factory, again, probably implemented as a separate class. Some people do it as a static method right on policy. So you'd have policy.new, and you give it all the invariants that are needed right up front, and it would create everything there. So it's a more of a esoteric pattern, I would say, when you first get into it. I find myself using them more and more as I go deeper into this, but that's neither here nor there. Another one is, and last I think one we'll touch on, is specification. Specification I just think of as a matcher, basically. It has a very simple interface. iSpecification.matches or iSpecification.isSatisfied by some entity. Great place to use something like generics. And in that case, what you're going to have is an entity, you're going to be able to have this class where you can feed an entity, and usually in the constructor, you give it whatever variables, and it will say, does this match? Honestly, I don't use a lot of these. I use some of them, but sometimes. But typically, I'm querying the database, you know, to get those things.
I'm trying to find an example of where I would even use one of those, and I can't think of one off.
Business rules. So you've got an entity, and you want to match whether or not you're going to. So you're going to do some operation, and then you're going to run down a conditional loop. You know, you're going to run down. You've got a fork, right? You want to say, well, if it matches this specification, execute this code, otherwise return. And it just cleans up the code. I think that's the main reason to do it. That's kind of why we use them for the most part. But
yeah, so it's like, you know, is it a valid loan? Does it meet all the criteria that the business has set? So, you know, if it's a purchase, is the actual value that the person has to put down, is it 20%? Crazy stuff like that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a very good use of it. I personally haven't found that there, we have some specifications, but that's pretty much how we're using them right now. So it's I have a crazy theory about, you know, casting them to expression of T, but we'll go over that some other time. It's a little more wacky.
It's like entities are the nouns, value objects are the mutable, repository is what you're going to persist, or database stuff. Specifications are the sort of the business rules per se. The factories are how you get and create and, you know, instantiate your entities, as you said earlier. So it's sort of like we're using the exact same stuff that we've always done, but we're just using different terms for it.
It is, and you know, we can cruise through this pretty quickly, but there are a lot of design points in the domain-driven design book about each one of these. And there are a lot of recommendations about how, you know, a lot of opinions, frankly, about how to do that. And I think to go through is one thing, to give people a survey, but you're going to have to read that book. I mean, you're really going to have to do your homework. There's a domain-driven design group on Yahoo, and it's a pretty civil group as far as email groups and the programming world go. And it's a great place to go if you have questions, like if you're just starting out. But I would really, not to harp on this, but I'd really say go get the book, read the book. You're gonna get a good handful of good ideas from it. Even if it's stuff you're doing now, it's going to move your practice up just another notch, you know?
Yeah, I think you also need to see it in action, because I'm listening to all this, and I know I haven't really spoken a lot because I've been trying to absorb this, but I get most of it. But if I could actually see it or sit down with someone and say, show me your models or show me the code that the ambiguous language represents, I think it would I would pick up on it a lot quicker and without a lot of questions. So I do recommend that people read the book. Probably there's a lot of good examples and a lot of good pictures. Definitely. and charts in there. But man, it would be great to have just maybe an hour sitting down with someone and seeing this in action.
Yeah, if anybody out there listening has a domain model, let us know. Contact us. Comments at Deep Fried Bytes. We'll put it up on the website. We'll send it out. If somebody has some, you know, just some samples, we're not asking for real world stuff. I mean, I guess David could upload his, you know, software that he's built to CodePlex and share it with everybody if you wanted to.
We're a commercial.
It's probably not going to happen.
I actually have a framework up for building models, but that isn't necessarily going to help you understand, you know, what an actual model looks like. And I think that's a big problem. Like I've done a number of talks on domain-driven design, and, you know, I've gotten better at it just because I think I started out with the very simple customer orders, and that was okay.
Sure.
But I think people, it really hits home when it's a real kind of thing that they can relate to. Not that we can't relate to customer orders, but I think it's been done to death, right? I think that we need to talk about things like loans or policy. So I now when I go out, I talk about, you know, workers' compensation policies. And it's something I know, and it's something we can show how these concepts or how I approach this problem or things like that. Now, I will say I heard, and I can't speak to the quality or whatever. I know some of the people, so I think the quality is probably pretty good based on past experience. But CodeCamp server has a domain model in it, I hear. Don't take my word for it, but CodeCamp server, we'll dig out the link. You guys can put it in the show notes. And that is got a domain model that represents CodeCamps. And anyone that's been to a CodeCamp, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have, will kind of be able to be a domain expert and actually go in and say, well, this is how it was implemented. So I think that would be one example where you could kind of drive people, take a look.
Yeah, now, CodeCamp server is on code.google.com/p/CodeCamp server.
And we'll have that in the show notes.
Yeah. And you definitely want to put the book, you know, put up the Amazon link if you can. And I think if you're going to read one computer, you know, programming book, software engineering book, I highly recommend it.
Are you getting commission on that book?
No.
You really
you know what? You go ahead and you put your affiliate code in there.
I don't think we even have an affiliate.
Well, now, you know, you're leaving a lot of money on the table.
Yeah. Maybe so.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is Quicken Loan overpays their developers because, you know, you don't need that affiliate money.
That's what I heard.
Hey, how about those Bears? I heard they're doing good this year. All right, Dave, well, I appreciate you coming on. We've talked, I think, enough about, like, entities and objects and stuff. I think we should go down the rabbit hole a little bit of explaining, like, how you do that, you know, more detail. We'll try to do as good of a job as we can with just a podcast, but I think that may be a good conversation to have. What do you think?
I'm available anytime. You know, it sounds good to me. It sounds fun. I'm in.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Thank you.